And actually, what happens in indigenous communities, it's turned on its head. It starts off with self-actualized. When we're born, we are self-actualized. We are immediately in the moment having those rich, visceral experiences. What we're building towards, if we go back to our Homo sapien, our real true human, is to this community of living together where all our needs, including the physical needs, but the need for love, the need for some autonomy within that, the need for a big need for play, because without play, life's not worth living.
Welcome to the Wild Minds podcast for people interested in health, nature-based therapy, and learning. We explore cutting-edge approaches that help us improve our relationship with ourselves, others, and the natural world. My name is Marina Robb. I'm an author, entrepreneur, forest school, outdoor learning, and nature-based trainer and consultant, and pioneer in developing green programs for the health service in the UK. Welcome back to season four. It's good to be back again, and I hope you're all doing really well. Well, we're beginning this season with episode 25, Why Love Matters. My guest today is my friend and co-author of our book, The Essential Guide to Forest School and Nature Pedagogy. For more than 40 years, John has been reconnecting people of all ages to the natural world. He's the founding director of the Forest School Association in the UK and passionate about how the forest school approach can help youngsters who find traditional schooling a challenge. For me, he shows how someone with so much experience can remain humble and at the same time have a massive exuberance for learning. He's no doubt one of the leading practitioners in the world in relation to outdoor learning, forest school, and models that facilitate more compassionate relationships with our wider communities. He's also the lead trainer on our certificate for nature-based training. Let's get going. So, welcome John Cree to the Wild Minds podcast. I've been so longing to have you on the show, so I'm just super happy and excited to have you here.
Yeah, it's felt like a long time of longing ever since I remember talking about the inception of the podcast and hearing your first couple, which I was in tears, particularly with the second one. And now we're on what episode? I can't remember.
You're right. We're actually at the beginning of season four, and I think it's episode sort of 25 or something. So, yeah.
Well, I think it's probably good that it's been till now. It's sort of, yeah, something.
It's been cooking, hasn't it?
Yeah, it's been cooking.
Yeah. Well, before we dive in, I mean, I just always start with gratitude. And I know this is something that we share both in our work and in our friendship and in the writing that we've done. So I know you're going to say yes to this. I don't think I have to ask your permission. But actually, what I wanted to start with is gratitude on just being able to laugh, because I often have to, you know, before we start talking, it's like, well, what is my gratitude? You know, what's real for me? And I was already laughing a little bit with you, a bit giggly, and I thought that I'm really grateful for that, because it doesn't happen all the time. And it does relax me. And when I laugh, it's kind of like a bit of silliness, a little bit of just a sprinkle of goodness that comes into every day. So I'm grateful for laughter with you, and I'm grateful for laughter generally. And yeah, I wonder if you'd share some gratitude.
Oh, thanks for that. You've made me tingle all over. It's just, I guess I'm just feeling that tingle and gratitude for my body. It's just that sort of whole thing, and the way that somebody else's laughter can infect somebody else's body and my body. even through the airwaves like this, electronically. So just really grateful that I have this nervous system that's mammalian that does that. And all the gratitudes that go with that in terms of that resonance with other life. So I'm grateful for that resonance with other life, I guess. Yeah. Having felt that little tingle. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you. Well, there is just absolutely so much that we could talk about. And, you know, I want to let listeners out there know that me and John, well, we work together on lots of different programs, but we've also written the book that's called The Essential Guide to Forest School and Nature Pedagogy. So I'm bringing that up because it kind of says a lot of what we're into, both of us. And, you know, I've already said in the introduction that, you know, you've got so many years experience working with young people and the outdoors, and that's not just under the banner of Forest School, but I know what's important to both of us is I suppose living well, but also, you know, how to be a part of changing something for the better. And I think for us it's been in education and in health. So I guess I'd love to start with a little bit of a conversation on, as a human, you talked about your body, right? So as a human, what are some of the things that you think are really important about being well, just as a general way in, and then we're going to look at some of the other things, no doubt.
Being well means that I can move. Really important, I think. I was out yesterday harvesting willow with a local, well, internationally known basket maker artist. And there's just something about movement with Jenny and harvesting willow and sorting it. And at the same time, because we're well, we're outside, but we're having this healthy conversation as well about life, about being grandparents. So there's something about, at the moment, I'm so glad I'm in the mid-60s, that I am well, that I can relish being a grandparent and actually do the things with a three-year-old and a six-month-old that if I wasn't well, I probably couldn't do, for example, that I can travel across the country to Sussex and work with you later this week and be with a load of health practitioners and actually to be able to hold space, because you need to be well to be able to hold space with the groups that we work with and in the community that I'm with. So I guess that's just some of the things that come to mind at the moment, because community is important. It's all part of that wholehearted living, isn't it, really, to be in connection with the human community and the more than human community, which is why I think I've led a blessed, privileged life, because I've always been outside with people. That's been my raison d'etre. So I'm getting my vitamin D at the same time.
Yeah.
My whole life.
I guess I'm thinking, you have worked for so many years outdoors, but you've also focused on working with a lot of people who have had more challenging upbringings or challenging situations. Thinking about the teenagers that you work with, and you know, you do a lot of trainings around needs. So there's something around being well physically, yeah. And you've mentioned about the importance of community already, but what about our basic needs? Because in a way, what I would like to do is think about, because I think, you know, people out there, we don't get taught this stuff. We don't get taught a way of thinking, okay, these are actually my needs, not our wants, my needs. And actually, when we don't have those needs met, then things can start to go a little bit challenging.
Yeah.
So, you know, and in a way, it's taken many years, both within our society, to start naming some of those needs. So I just for people that don't know, when we say needs or the things that help us be well, could you just kind of frame that a little bit, and then we can kind of go.
Definitely.
Yeah.
I mean, it's interesting. anybody in education will get taught when we go to teach training. I think we still do get taught about what our basic needs are in the context of Maslow's hierarchy of needs. Yeah. And it's quite interesting looking at Maslow. He's works a lot with indigenous communities, which I've only recently found out about, and how the hierarchy has got a little bit co-opted by politics, if you like, our social system in the West. And we forget, actually, that hierarchy was something that he saw wasn't necessarily true to humans. And we often see, because of that, that our basic needs are just the physical needs, the need for a shelter, the need for food, the need for warmth, to sort of just look after the physicality of the body being the basis of everything else. And eventually we might get to that self-actualization need at the end. And actually, what happens in indigenous communities, it's turned on its head. It starts off with self-actualized. When we're born, we are self-actualized. We are immediately, in the moment, having those rich, visceral experiences. And what we're building towards, if we go back to our Homo sapien, our real true human, is to this community of living together where all our needs, including the physical needs, but the need for love, the need for some autonomy within that, the need for a big need for play, because without play, life's not worth living. So just sitting down and watching the Six Nations at the moment for me, that's my playtime, if you like, particularly if I'm sitting down with a group of friends and that's part of play.
Adult play.
Mm-hmm. Adult
yeah.
play.
Yeah.
And that's essential. I look forward to it and it enriches life. It brings joy, all of that, as well as going out and singing around a fire in the woods. So, yeah, we've got all those physical needs, but actually the most important one is going back to what we were saying at the beginning with gratitude for, is this community. And the glue of a community is love. And I'm not meaning just eros. I mean love for it. And it's sort of, like yesterday working with the willow worker, I know her daughter really well because she's best friends with my youngest daughter. I only met Jenny a couple of times. So we had such a connective day yesterday. And I felt there was a bit of love exchange, even though we've only just met each other properly for a whole day. And it was just from that, we started talking about common interests, which you do. So we're going to go canoeing together and she's going to teach me some more complex weaving. And I felt a little tug of love. And we're scared of that word, aren't we? But it is, for me, that's the most universal need. And with love comes other needs. We need accompaniment, which is a big thing. We all need care. We all need that compassion. That's what I think we're all seeking. But amongst that, we also want some autonomy and power over our lives. So that's quite a long answer to that needs thing. But I just think it's so important, having worked with youngsters, I've sort of right from the start tried to see our relationship rather than a learning relationship. The first thing is just looking at it. What are their needs so that they can feel self-fulfilled and get to that actualization and be part of that? Because our Western society takes it as sort of put that top of the hierarchy at further on in life almost, rather than actually invert it. It's right at the start of life in our true indigenous ways. And if you go back in our ancestry, yeah.
Yeah. It needed a long answer. Sorry. It needed a long answer because here we are back at love.
Yes.
And it is curious to me how it often feels that is, you know, I remember actually growing up and being, you know, a teacher as well. And actually, I don't think we ever mentioned love. Love is, you know, that feeling of love and care and of course, having a sense of love towards yourself, meaning that you actually can, in a sense, care for your, be caring towards yourself, to sort of soothe yourself and stuff like that, is so important and so absent. And I'm wondering, when I hear you speak, I'm thinking about a lot of the settings, a lot of the school settings, and it doesn't feel like it has those qualities. And I want to kind of be careful here, because I don't want to participate in kind of slagging off teachers in any way.
No, you know,
and I know you don't, and I would be saying the same for health practitioners. We know how much is put upon them and how stressful it is in the environment and how, you know, so many demands. So I just want to name that, you know, let's put that aside. However, when I go into those environments, I wouldn't say there's a lot of that feeling that you're describing. However, I would say in the settings that we're in outdoors, though it's not overtly named love, there is this, as you say, this kind of being alongside, having those joyful moments, and also being alongside those sad moments. So there's a difference going on, I think, in our school systems, and I'd love to talk to you more about that, because I know that there's so many places we can go with this. But if wellness has a connection to this wholehearted community and attends to needs, how can we do this more in a school setting, and what's actually going on?
So I just wanted to start off by reinforcing what you've just said. We're talking about system generally, because there are schools I walk into and you immediately get it. You get that feeling. You know it's happening, despite as being in this hierarchical, dictatorial system, because the curriculum's dictated from Westminster in this country, very much so, and Ofsted. And that trickles down to the people who are delivering that system. And sometimes it can be really hard for schools, but having been into lots and lots of schools, some you know, actually, this is a caring, nurturing, loving community. You just get that feeling right from the initial greeting and welcome. So I just wanted to name that it is just the general system we're in, not individual schools and teachers who are trying their damnedest in these very stressful times. And I think it sometimes gets worse when it gets more stressy. We're now probably in the biggest funding crisis in education, and possibly and the health system. And because of that, that trickles through, doesn't it? It seeps through. We've got lots of nervous systems that are in this heightened state, or in this dissociative state, to deal with the stresses of lack of status. I mean, in my lifetime, teachers used to be revered, respected a lot, and that's shifted. A lack of resources, bigger class sizes, more crowded curriculum. So I've got less quality time to have. So those are all the reasons why we can walk in and think, actually, that's why the love isn't coming through so much, because it does take time and effort to get to know every individual child. When we've got class sizes that are over 30, all of that in the primary sector, and a lot of big secondary schools, which have got bigger and bigger and bigger. And I've seen that in my lifetime, just these big super schools that just, it's not on a human scale. So I think we have to try and get back to that human scale. Somehow, and I think we've got to seriously look at teacher training. I mean, every teacher should be said right at the start, if you don't love them, this is not the profession for you, for example. And I think we have to really sort of push that message home, because we know from all the neurobiology and the neuroscience, unless we've got our emotional circuits, which are all over the brain and in the body, in that attentive state that's not stressed, then we're not going to get into the full problem-solving, executive functioning way, because the two go hand in hand. The left and the right lobes go hand in hand, but we've concentrated on the left lobe very much so in this society. And it is a whole system. And I think that's where the wholesomeness comes in for me. We've forgotten that actually the main reason we've got a brain is to look after the body, and the body feeds up to the brain. That is the main reason we have a brain. We have a brain that's so complex. It's because it's looking after this body that is just can do all sorts of things. And we have imagination and all the rest of it, but its prime function is to look after the body. And I think we've forgotten that. And to look after other bodies. And if we put the other bodies under stress, so if we're berating children at a very young age, they're shutting down. And yet you look at all indigenous culture, that beration doesn't happen. There's no aggression at all. There's only community care.
Yeah.
So it's, which is important for raising a child, as we know. I mean, that old adage, it takes a village to raise a child, is so true.
Yeah.
I don't know whether that answers your question. I just think I've got this thing about just our health systems, our education systems. There's something about that human scale that's so important. My dad died just before Christmas, and it was in the main hospital in Oxford, and the main consultant he was under, the care was amazing. And the consultant had worked at the biggest hospital in Bristol and the biggest hospital in Nottingham, which are super hospitals. And he said, the reason you've had such good care here is this is a small hospital. And yet, to start off, I saw it as big. But and then when we were going for 5 days, just looking after being with Dad, it did get smaller, and it didn't take long to walk to where he was. And it was, I suddenly realised, and he hit the nail on the head the day he died. He said, that's why I stayed here, because it's a smaller hospital. It was just really interesting seeing that quality of care compared to my mum, who was up in Nottingham, and she hated having to go from one end of the QE to the other end, and it took ages. It's not geared for her, who was an infirm old lady in a wheelchair, scared about where to park and all the rest of it. I've got to get across this great big hospital. And that sort of, you get that feeling from the staff as well, that it's sort of, they're all a bit more compartmentalised and it's not so wholesome and holistic, because you can't have that connection.
Are you ready to elevate your forest school skills and breathe new life into your sessions? Don't allow doubt to hinder your exploration of outdoor learning's potential. Without proper direction, young people may miss out on nature's profound impact. Imagine confidently guiding your groups through parks or green spaces equipped with essential skills. Explore theoutdoorteacher.com/forest school for my premier online training in forest school activities and begin your path towards becoming a skilled outdoor educator today. And don't forget, if you're in the UK, you have the opportunity to experience the wonders of nature firsthand at one of our direct trainings in Sussex. Dive into the details of our in-person courses at circleofliferediscovery.com.
So there's something about scale here.
Absolutely. I think it's really important. In fact, I was reading the newspaper at the weekend, which I don't do very much anymore, but it was saying, this is shocking, it was saying that a third of secondary school students are not going to schools because of their levels of anxiety. And again, I know we're both, you know, involved and care personally about mental health. And, you know, this was a reputable newspaper, you know, saying this. So I would suggest as well that there's a biological, physiological response going into an environment with thousands of young people where you're having to watch very carefully what's going on. You know, your neuroception, your high alert, you know, what's so-and-so going to say, what's so-and-so going to react, how do I look, all those things that we know, we remember. I mean, I can remember it too, you know. So they're big environments, and on some level, they really are quite scary. However, this is what we've got at the moment. And I think it is interesting, because I've also been thinking how things change. And this, well, like we know as being very much part of the forest school movement, how actually within these big environments, primary and secondary and nursery, one of the reasons it's definitely worked is because in a way the schools have carved these spaces within the big machine, have said, okay, you know, every Friday or every Thursday morning, they're going to go out, and they're going to go out in smaller groups. And this is part of their everyday school life. Obviously, some schools do it, you know, throughout the year, others do it for sections, don't they?
Yeah.
But I think there are ways of working within these big systems to create smaller spaces.
Definitely. And,
you know, yeah. So I think, but you're absolutely right. Size is really important. And then of course the knock on of the size is then the quality of the relationships.
Yes.
Yeah. And if we're saying a prime need is, which we are saying, is this relational quality, you know, to feel listened to feel, you know, witnessed, to feel we have value for that person, then it's something that is essential in, I guess, what we would call good pedagogy, or, you know, good environments, regardless of what you call it. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Definitely, because it does take time to build those relationships, I think, particularly now we've got so many distractions with the screen. And having said that, I felt the resonance right at the start, but you don't really get that visceral feeling unless you are alongside somebody physically. And you get it even more when you're alongside somebody and sharing it with other non-human elements of our world, the other plants, animals, rocks, soils, all the rest of it. And when you combine the two, there's just, because we've lived with it for thousands and thousands of years, and it's in our genetic makeup. We just have to get back to it, that old biophilia hypothesis, which is, you know, has been taken on board by the health service, for example. Probably not in education, it's not a common term, but it's there, that we have this innate genetic emotional connection, not just to humans, but to certainly other higher order mammals. When you look at the way they think and feel, we now know that in our mammalian, in our brain, this is not the lizard brain, isn't just here. We've realised in reptiles there's actually the neocortex, which is the bit where we assign to humans. It's bits of neocortex in reptiles. Mm. So we're finding this out more and more, that our neurobiology is so similar in many ways to all sorts of animals. And we don't just have this primitive lizard brain that sends us into fight and flight. It's all connected. This is where the wholesome thing comes in. It's completely all connected. And I think we get that more, that visceral feeling more, if we're outdoors in connection with it, listening to birdsong, hearing the wind in the trees. And I know with youngsters who are challenged by a system, they get it too.
Absolutely.
Totally get it. And then the knock-on effect is they start feeling us and getting us too.
Yeah. I mean, it makes me think again about what you were saying about hierarchy, because you talked about, you know, the way Maslow has been interpreted like a triangle, you know, like a pyramid. And obviously we often work in circles, you know, whether that's circles around a fire or sitting in circles, because it flattens the kind of way we relate with each other. And I'd like to talk about that because one of the, I mean, I've been really thinking about over the last few months about punishment and discipline and self-punishment in a way, the way we talk to ourselves internally and how quite scarily, in my opinion, I started to see it in lots of places, this kind of dominating way we often are in this world, you know, whether actually how close we might be to if we don't behave, what might happen. And we could take that in all kinds of ways, but let's start with a school system. And again, it's not the individual teachers necessarily, but I've got, you know, because we work with a lot of the disenfranchised, the people that actually have left school. You know, I know many of our years have been working with, you know, PRUs, you know, people referral units and all those. I've forgotten now what they're all called.
All
those kind of children. Yeah. So, and you know, what often is said that when they're outside or in these settings which isn't so hierarchical, suddenly you've got these lovely young people, you know, and it's not always lovely. I get it. You know, of course not. That, you know, it's there's a lot of reactions and defensiveness in those settings too, of course. But there's something about flattening, and I'd love to talk about what you think's going on there, you know, a little bit, you know, about these, you know, this idea of a kind of dominating system, dominating, you know, us on the top kind of looking down, saying you must do this, or hang on, you haven't done it right, wrong, constantly, to this kind of more sense of partnership model. What do we mean by that? And what could you share about that? So I think it's really important. I think we're talking about a change in quite fundamental changes in the way we would like things to work, aren't we?
Yeah, we are. And again, it's just to reinforce, it's not denigrating individual teachers or even some individual schools, but we're in this system where I think since the Industrial Revolution, we've wanted people to comply to what society wants, and we felt like cogs in a wheel, and to get people to actually just be so focused at being this cog in the wheel, we've come down on the side, we're going to do it through coercion, through punishments and rewards. And I guess the biggest reward is the pay packet at the end of the day. And yet we know, looking at health and well-being and joy and all the rest of it, there comes a point where that pay packet doesn't. But that's always the big reward, isn't it? Is we're going to get paid more, therefore we can enjoy life more, but we may have to really grind it out for most of our lives to get the enjoyment from the... It's just, and it's shown that it doesn't correlate, that there's only so much money that we need to get the basic physical needs. And money, I mean, that old Beatles song, money can't buy love. Buy me love, all of that is going back to one of our most fundamental needs is that. But another fundamental need we're talking about is autonomy. And that, I think, was where the punishment and reward system backfires on itself. Because we've got somebody else trying to control us. And we use all that controlling language. If you don't do that, then I'm going to do this to you. Right down to family parent. And we do it as parents.
Yeah,
if you don't
it's
do
really
that,
hard. It's really
you don't
hard.
Go to bed tonight properly. You're not going to get that toy.
Yeah, I've done that.
Yeah, we've all
done it with food
because we're in that culture. And you know what happens, and just seeing it with particularly with the grandchildren at the moment, even the slightest thing that we all do, you can see this suddenly there's a bit of shame coming in with the 3-year old. Who's totally apologetic and goes into the shoulders and wants to hide because they've done something wrong that they're not sure why or what, because I've got this basic need to play at the moment. Back to that big need. And you're coming in here with my adult agenda, with your adult agenda, and I'm not enough.
Yeah.
So it does backfire on us, and then we get people going, well, F you.
Yeah.
And this isn't, I'm not feeling fulfilled, therefore I'm either going to fight, and my body does go into fight, and my thinking body says, right, I've got to protect myself here, so I'm going to go into fight. And I come out of my thinking body and it's getting into fight. Or I'm going to go into flight. I just need to run away from it. Or, and this is the dangerous one, I'm going to shut down. I can't engage with this anymore. Shut down. And we now know all the inflammatory diseases, internal inflammatory diseases, are due to that stress and shutting down. And organs literally shutting down. And I think there's something about the sort of education of people, not just in the education profession, but even in the medical profession, and they're knowing more and more about this, that dissociation is one of the biggest causes of all our diseases, diabetes, the whole MS, all of it, which is the inflammatory diseases, we now know is to do with this response of our nervous system to shut down. And I can't deal with it anymore. We have the biggest mental health crisis we've ever had in the UK, not in the US, in the UK and around the planet now, percentage-wise. I don't think we get that, but it's not, that's certainly not broadcast big time, I don't think. It is a crisis. We're in this polycrisis at the moment. And the antidote to that is empathy, compassion, love, care. Feeling part of a community where I've got a bit of autonomy and I can actually bring what I've got to bear. I think we have to get right down to even the smallest ways we talk, going from this demanding, dominative language to a much more observational language. Oh, I can see you're upset and you're playing. And I think if we could go to bed, you may get more sleep and feel good tomorrow, rather than the, right, I'm going to punish you for not going to bed by depriving you of this. So if we can get to that more empathic language.
Yeah. It's interesting because I think that the argument, or one of the arguments, is that, well, it kind of does work. You know, it works in the short term, doesn't it? It's kind of like we comply, mostly we behave. You know, and we learn. I mean, you know, I think we forget that we're doing this as adults. We're socially complying. You know, I don't say that, because if I say that, I'm going to have that reaction. So we're always doing it. But like you say, at what cost do we shut down, both physiologically, but also knowing our needs? Being able to say, actually, I really love that. Why can't I go and investigate how soil works? You know, why? You know, it's a constant kind of like, no, you can't do that now. You have to do that, but I'm not interested in that. Okay, you know, and then I get punished somehow. And in that, I know from my own self that we start dismissing ourselves, and we end up not really knowing ourselves. We're not really knowing what brings us joy, what doesn't bring us joy. That's really important too, you know, what we don't like. So it does have huge ramifications. And I guess I'm wondering, within a school system, you know, because when we work within a kind of less hierarchical system, we often talk about guidelines or things that are going to keep us safe, don't we? It's this participatory way of holding a group, and we are holding a group. It's not that there aren't any boundaries, right? It's not a freedom free for everything, but we are holding this group. There's a sense of integrity within ourselves, saying this is okay and this is not okay. However, here we are as a group. Let's co-participate and think, what's going to work here? What's going to work? You know, and then we have a chance to engage. And like you said, I suppose we're consenting.
And that's the thing, we're consenting. And I think, I mean, the hope in all of this for me is that we now know through the neurobiological research that's out there now, we've done so much, and there's so much more to discover about through functional MRI and all the rest of it. Functional MRI, not just on our brain, but on our nervous system, seeing how neurons are flowing and the energy flows through our autonomic nervous system. But actually, a much better way to find our potential within society is through that much more connective, less coercive, empathic way of being. And you can see lots of glimmers around that. I mean, there's lots of talk about banning Ofsted at the moment, for example. Is this really healthy? And that is getting up to government level. They are starting to debate, do we need an inspection system like this? Really, is this going against proper learning and the creative learning that's needed to get us through these polycrises that we're facing at the moment? So that's the hope for me, is that that will trickle through. And I think it is starting to trickle through. The fact that Forest School, I would never have imagined when it all kicked off in the late 90s, that there'd be thousands and thousands and thousands of kids all over the country going out on a regular basis, albeit possibly just a couple of hours a week, but it's more than it was before. And teachers having that time and space to sit back and observe and really think about these quality relationships and what the real learning is through play that's happening here, and giving children a chance to experiment with, well, if my bag is all about textiles and crafts, well, I can work with that outside. If my bag is I'm really into the maths, then we can work with that. And giving people a little bit more autonomy to work with that. And we're just there on tap. We don't necessarily have to be designing a lesson that's designed as per the curriculum says it should be. I can explore it in my own way.
Well, that kind of brings us to teacher training in a way again, because, you know, there is a confidence needed, isn't there, to feel, and I guess this actually comes from a growing up in a society that gives you more autonomy, because that actually is what builds confidence.
It does, but it's autonomy within a community. That's the point. You can't have it without, that one goes with the other. You can't have them both. So there is no such thing, as we all realise, which Maggie Thatcher says, there's no such thing as society. Of course there is. We wouldn't be here as humans. We wouldn't have survived without our tribe out in the wild. We wouldn't survive today without having like a community. That's what keeps my well-being going, is that community and the little wood that I'm part of, and friendships here, and just being able to go out with a willow worker that I can see that friendship, that community growing. And that's what brings me purpose and joy.
So how then do we support more of this approach, this community wholesome approach? Because again, I think I absolutely agree with you that if I don't feel that I have, that I belong anywhere, that I'm valued, that someone would miss me. I mean, that's my emotional side, you know, that I have value in a community, then life's pretty lonely, life's pretty sad. So how, in your experience, are there basic ways of building of building that sense of community?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's partly just getting to know what makes people tick. So if you take the education system, I don't think we have enough room and space as teachers to really get to know our kids, to find out what makes them tick so that they know that they can do this. We were talking about a youngster yesterday, and she's at primary school now, and she's feisty, she's there, and sometimes she loves learning, absolutely devours it, but quite often comes home from school saying, I hate school. And it's because she hates being told what to do. And she'll come home from some days and say, I love school, because she's actually been given a bit of space and time to explore what her passions are. She loves history, by all accounts. She really likes delving into all of that. She's only 6 or 7. She also loves being outside. Absolutely has to be outside. But she's into just looking at the past and what's gone on before. And so it's sort of swings and roundabouts for her. But I think I'm getting the impression that she doesn't like the demand language that's coming. She much prefers the more invitational language and the shall we, and the observational language we're talking about, which takes a shift from our system, which is all about demands, to a much more invitational, observational, oh, this is what's going on. I'm here to support you and be alongside you, way of being. And I think there is something in our training systems that needs to shift. There's something about bringing the neurobiology into our professions much, much more than it is at the moment to show, well, our science is showing this now. This is what we need. And if you look at attachment, that's sort of come on in leaps and bounds in terms of the neurobiology. So there's knowing that there is a need for safety and warmth and containment, clear boundaries, but there's also a need for that soft mutual gaze, shared attention and intention and focus, and that skin-to-skin contact. We're totally scared of that now, but that's so important. Rhythmic movement, synchronized movement in terms of body-based stuff. A pleasure in terms of smiles, laughter, and play, if you like, fun. The alteration between arousing activities and time for quiet reflection. All of those things and a need for connection to the more than human are essential for healthy relationship and attachment and healthy learning and healthy lives. We know that through all the neurobiology that's coming through.
Yeah, I mean, I'd like to kind of sort of pull this last bit together around that, because, of course, we wouldn't be doing the work we're doing if it wasn't about really feeling this deeper connection with the natural world and how that's saved our lives, informed our lives, given us great joy. And I feel that it's in this conversation, it's important to explore just a little bit around how that needs to underpin our education and our systems, that economic, all these systems need to be underpinned by this familiarity, if you like, this understanding of that, this wider ecosystem that's informing us, but not from a rational perspective, but from a sense of love, perhaps, you know, or what that is, because we can't harm the things we love. You know, I really feel like that we protect, most of us would, well, we jump in if our child was in danger, you know, and pull them out. We would just go whack straight away. We wouldn't think about it. Our whole body would respond. And then we'd go, whew, yeah. And there's something going on here that we're just not reacting, are we? We're not. And I know there's lots of reasons, but just to kind of, I'd love to just speak to that, because it is so important in our work. We wouldn't be doing this work if it wasn't for building those attachments to the natural world. I just wonder if you'd kind of speak to that, and perhaps we'd end there.
Yeah. You know where I've just gone? I've just gone to Gaza. It's just only because, and the olive groves, which are the places of peace, both for Israelis and the Palestinians. And there's a reason for that. And there's a commonality there in terms of that being one of the olive basins of the world, if you like. And digging back into ancestry, that's always connected to the natural thing that's grown there. that's in our physiology. And I think sometimes you have to peel back those conflicts and say, what commonalities have we got here? And often is that connection to the land. And I know it's the land they're fighting over, but they forget why they're connected to the land fundamentally, emotionally and physically, not culturally necessarily. So I'm talking about those basic needs. And there's this visceral connection that's an emotional connection on that level of this land sustains me. I can put aside the dominative religious side of it, if you like. And I know there's a spiritual in there, and we forget there's this common spiritual thread as well, both between Jews and Muslims. There's a common spiritual thread. So that's why just bringing it back to the land and the natural world is often a beginning point of resolving conflict and feeling a stake in the world. It's the same here, I think. You can see it. Forest school is a leveller. It's a real leveller between sexes, between cultures. And having worked with schools in the middle of Birmingham, and there's a real mix of cultures, but there's a commonality there. I'll never forget the first, one of the first forest schools we set up in Worcestershire, for the first local authority, Stanley Road in the middle of Worcester, and parents coming in, suddenly being in tears and connecting, because this is the land. This is what we used to do. I mean, we're cooking together, cross-culture, and it's this visceral thing that just really helps. Then we can become that and do the real work of play and learning together in community. So having seen it and experienced it time and time again in some of the most multicultural communities, it's powerful stuff. And I've been in tears quite a lot when I just witnessed that connection happening between people because of the land bringing stuff up that's ancestral.
Absolutely. Thank you so much. I'm left with, I don't know, just a sense of that when we look into the other, you know, that there is that connection, and we sort of started the conversation around this feeling in the body of love, and I feel like we've come back to that somehow, and I'm happy to stay with that and be with that feeling, because it's the thing that's gonna keep us going for a long time. So thanks, John, and speak and see you soon.
Thanks, Marina.
Thanks so much for speaking to me, John. What a pleasure. Join me next week for episode 26, where I discuss behaviour as communication and take a look at the role of punishment in our systems and the impact of this approach on our well-being and potential. Thank you for listening to this episode of the Wild Minds podcast. If you enjoyed it and want to help support this podcast, please subscribe, share, and leave a rating and review wherever you get your podcasts. Your review will help others find the show. To stay updated with the Wild Minds podcast and get all the behind-the-scenes content, you can visit theoutdoorteacher.com or follow me on Facebook at The Outdoor Teacher UK and LinkedIn, Marina Robb. The music was written and performed by Jeff Robb. See you next week, same time, same place. Have you ever wondered about the guitar music in my podcast? Well, it's actually my husband, Jeff Robb. Jeff's touring England and Wales with The Music of Trees, blending woodland-inspired music with stories about trees. Catch him in May, June, and July. Details and tickets at jeffrobb.com. www.thegoodtobeback.com/shows.